So let's expand our focus now from a regional issue to a national one, because labor union membership and power have certainly dwindled all over the country over several decades. This is a trend well tracked by our next guest in a book published last year. Raymond Hogler is the author of The End of American Labor Unions. The title pretty much says it all. Subtitle, The Right to Work Movement and the Erosion of Collective Bargaining. Raymond Hogler teaches about labor and employment relations as a professor of management at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
So I wonder at the outset, when you give students the history of the prior strength of the labor movement, how surprised are they?
They're surprised. And what I try to do is to talk about the decline of the labor movement in the context of rising inequality. I really try to explain, as your previous guest said, Trump is kind of an unknown entity, and his election, I think, was a surprise. But the base of his strength really was in these industrial states, which were previously highly unionized, Michigan, Wisconsin. What happened, I think, was that as these good jobs disappeared, people became very unhappy, and Trump tapped into that discontent. And the further implication of that is that these states may consider and pass right-to-work laws.
All right, so this didn't happen all at once. You cite in your book a book from 1986 that showed the decline coming. What did the authors see on the way?
The problem was that this is a long, slow process. There are some people who argue, and I agree with this perspective, that really the turning point came with Taft-Hartley in 1947 when Section 14B was passed. Previous to that time, the law did not allow states to opt out of the federal rules. This created an exception whereby states could enact laws prohibiting union security. Your previous guest said, yes, we have all these contracts with grocery stores, other facilities, and we're very strong there because we can require everybody, he said, to be a member of the union, but actually it's only to pay dues. But you can require dues payments, and that effectively creates a condition of solidarity. If you allow people to opt out of that, as right-to-work states do, then you have this erosion of collective solidarity and strength.
And you don't mince words in your book. You call right-to-work a lethal malignancy infecting today's labor movement. That's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, well, you can go on the web. The Conversation, which is a website that publishes opinion, and a few days ago I put up an opinion called Why America's Labor Unions Are About to Die. So I didn't mince words there either. And I think this is a terrible problem for labor unions moving forward, because Trump does have the right to appoint a Supreme Court justice. If this justice sides with Samuel Alito and three others who believe that public sector union dues requirements to pay dues are unconstitutional, that will tremendously injure the public sector union movement in this country. And the public sector union movement is the one that has membership and growth.
Not in the private sector?
Not in the private sector. And furthermore, Trump has the option to appoint two new members to the National Labor Relations Board. Frankly, I don't think Trump knows what the National Labor Relations Board is, other than they charged him with unfair labor practices. They do a lot of other things, and they make rules and regulations, and they've tended to drift toward facilitating union organizing. Two new members could reverse that easily, because they do things by rules and precedent, and a new majority could change existing rules and precedent.
Let's talk about what that actually means then for the folks who aren't in organized labor, and I think that's the majority of people who probably are listening. Right to work,
right,
or right to shirk, as our previous guest called it,
yeah,
means what?
It just means that you don't have to support labor unions. The way it works is this: in a non-right to work state, a union security state, a union can come in and organize employees, and then they can ask the employer to sign an agreement that says all members of the unit who are covered will pay union dues. In right-to-work states, that kind of security clause, as it's called, is illegal. Therefore, you can't have it. That doesn't mean that people in right-to-work states like Tennessee wouldn't pay union dues. It just means they can't be obligated to pay it. And quite frankly, this is a problem in America, this logic of collective action. If we allow people to opt out of something like listen to public radio without supporting it, then you have a problem of free ridership. That's what union dues are all about.
So the people who are getting the benefits of the contract negotiation but not paying the dues are literally free riders, you're saying?
Free riders, that's right. They get the benefits. They don't pay for them. And people listen to NPR and don't pay for it. So you have this problem. How do you enforce collective action when you allow for people to opt out? That's always been a problem in the United States. In my book, I go back to 1806. Courts were arguing about this, whether or not unions could force people to become members and pay dues. There were a number of cases beginning in 1806 through the 19th century, and we had a big debate. It was settled in the National Labor Relations Act, but in 1947, Congress modified that, and now here we are.
So is it that the union ends up weaker because it doesn't have the income from the dues? What I'm trying to figure out the pathway of the mechanism here.
It's a dynamic, and the trouble with unions is that they have to expend resources on organizing, and many of them do that to a large extent. If you don't have those resources coming in, it's hard to generate further organizing activity and then to recoup those dues, especially, as I said, in right-to-work states. As a practical matter, I will tell you some of people that I know in the labor movement, excellent organizers, think that right-to-work is not a problem, but that's because they're good organizers. They go in, they organize something in Mississippi. They persuade everybody to pay dues. The problem is it's a national issue because as union membership declines nationally, it erodes at all levels the effectiveness of union organization.
We're talking to Raymond Hogler on the Jefferson Exchange. He teaches labor and employment relations as a professor of management at Colorado State University. He's the author of The End of American Labor Unions. He has predicted the death of labor unions in America. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760. Maybe you have experiences in a union or decided not to join at some point. We'd like to hear your story. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. I was a member of AFSCME before I retired. So 229 years ago, a group of rich white men got together and formed a constitution, which was later ratified by the states. And ever since then, every time a group has organized in order to get a piece of the pie, there's been a backlash. And you talked about Taft-Hartley, the backlash against unionization. So now rich white men control, in the coming year, will control the House, the Senate, the presidency, and as soon as a person is put on the Supreme Court, they'll also control that. So what do you see as the future for unions in the future? I think that your end of union process is ongoing, and how do you see that's going to play out?
All right, thanks, Ann.
Thank you.
Yes, that's a very interesting point. People who talk about unions are usually aware of a very famous economist named George Barnett, who back in 1928 predicted the death of unions, and then the Depression happened. Unions reached their greatest power and resurgence in the 1950s, basically because of the momentum of the CIO during the Depression. So you have to be kind of careful predicting the death of unions. I think you're exactly right. Everything you said is quite accurate. I only hope that it doesn't take the kind of cataclysm that happened in the 1930s to renew the American labor movement. Perhaps there will be a political awareness about workers. It's just unfortunate, in my opinion, that it turned out to be Donald Trump who miraculously became the savior of American workers. The guy is a billionaire. I don't think he's ever devoted much attention to working people before, but he managed to capture the imagination and the support of workers. partly because of this long ongoing decline.
Well, the political involvement in labor, though, obviously goes outside the presidency and generally has up till now. And you give the example of the United Auto Workers wanting to unionize Volkswagen workers in Tennessee with Volkswagen's support. What happened there?
Yes, that was a very interesting case, because what Volkswagen said was that we will allow you to form and participate in our works council. The peculiar nature of American labor law doesn't allow an outside union to come in as a minority representative. In other words, they have to be certified as a representative. Volkswagen said to the UAW, we will allow you to do that if you can become certified, that is, have an election. And Bob Corker, who's up for some, he's in the parade of possibles in the Trump administration.
Right, he's a senator from Tennessee.
Yes, he's a senator from Tennessee. He came out publicly 2 days before the election and said, I have been assured by Volkswagen that they will move a large part of their facility from Tennessee if this vote succeeds. That was absolutely untrue. Volkswagen denied that they ever said that, but the damage was done.
And so in
That's
the process,
Corker.
Yeah, so they voted down the union because of this political interference, you're saying?
Yeah, yes. And what can the union do? They can't file an unfair labor practice charge against Senator Corker. Now he's one of the primary candidates for some important office in the Trump administration.
He's certainly been talked about that. We'll come back and talk more about the situation with American labor unions. Raymond Hogler is the author of The End of American Labor Unions, so you can tell where his focus goes. As he points out, he's not the first person to predict the end of American labor unions. We'll come back and pick up the conversation and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're in the middle of a discussion about labor unions in America today. This was all kindled by the talk of a one-day strike that was supposed to happen today in California, but SEIU Local 1000 called the strike off on Friday in favor of further bargaining with the state of California. So no strike today, but we've had a chance to explore labor's conditions generally, both here in our region and a little more broadly. We're having the broad discussion now with Raymond Hogler, who is a professor of management at Colorado State University and the author of a book called The End of American Labor Unions, The Right to Work Movement and the Erosion of Collective Bargaining. It certainly touched a nerve. We have some phone calls waiting. You can join as well. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You do keep a good focus on broader trends here, Raymond, and especially the votes for right to work laws at the very time that attention is turning to inequalities in income. How do you explain those two trends happening at the same time?
I explain it very simply. I think the decline of unions is strongly correlated with the decline of equality, meaning that in the past, when labor unions were able to successfully negotiate a better share of our productive wealth, inequality tended to be less. Those data are clear. There's no argument about that. As unions decline, inequality rises. That was the occasion for Donald Trump being elected.
Well, do unions get the blame in some cases for sending jobs away, either to different states or to different countries?
There are very interesting articles being published on this right now. And Paul Krugman, who you know, the Nobel won,
from the New York Times,
economist, yeah, he says the problem is not the offshoring necessarily. Technology has a great deal to do with this. Other people have argued the same. There are trends that are discernible which do not predict very well for the future, and those trends are more technology, more trade, and a number of other economic issues. But by and large, I think technology has to be looked at in this mix to say it's partly that's why jobs are leaving, not just necessarily money.
But there have been cases when jobs were moved from state to state. General Electric taking its locomotive production from Pennsylvania to Texas, for example, and Boeing made a major threat that got it some concessions, didn't it?
Boeing made a major threat to move from Seattle to South Carolina. South Carolina was jumping up and down, and the reason those states try to attract industry is that their right to work. They make that a very prominent feature of their argument. The reason they do that is not necessarily because they don't like unions in general, but they couple that with the idea we have lower wage rates than other places, so you'd be more competitive. That's an argument that strikes home for a lot of companies, to be in a right-to-work state. It's not necessarily they don't like unions. It's not necessarily that they don't even mind paying a little higher wages. What they don't like is the perception that they have to become embroiled in, as they call it, some third party to help them manage their business.
Interesting. But it's interesting, too, that you mentioned South Carolina, because South Carolina was where some of the worst aspects of slavery spread in the Deep South. And you do draw a direct line from slavery to treatment of labor today.
Indeed, I do, because I think that slavery and the culture that was created in the United States because of slavery is one of the fundamental propositions we live with. It's very simple. All you have to do is to look at the Electoral College votes, and you can see that every former slave state voted for Donald Trump. Every former slave state is a right-to-work state. Every former slave state follows the same trajectory that they have for a long time, which is low wages and trying to attract development by offering subsidies and better working conditions, if you will. And I don't mean working conditions in general. I mean for employers, better working conditions.
Better economic climate for them.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some calls here. We have Tom in Jackson County on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Raymond Hogler, the author of The End of American Labor Unions. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I just wanted to introduce the factor of human nature. Mm-hmm. I'm a retired union member, and I could see unions going down back in the 60s and 70s when I was working, where the unions made this country strong. They created the middle class, and people had something to fight for. But management would dangle the carrot in front of the ones they knew would go for it, the people that were put on as foremen and pushers on jobs. And pretty soon you saw conditions going down. And, for instance, we worked refineries, and if it started raining, if it was before noon, you knocked off and you got paid till noon. If it started raining at 12:01, you knocked off and got paid for the whole day. In the early 70s, that went to, if it started raining, you worked or you got fired. And just one instance, but they would promise guys money behind their back so the others, union guys, if they'd get them working a little bit harder, of course they would, with the threat of being fired. But the unions themselves started going down too. Whenever you got a big pot of union funds sitting there, people can't help but get their fingers in it, and pretty soon people didn't trust the union reps. Mm-hmm. And management was always on the outside there, always working on the people they knew they could get at. And,
all right, Don, thanks for that. I appreciate it. With the perspective, let's get a response from Raymond. Thanks for that.
Yes, I agree. Unions are like any other institution. As they mature, they encounter problems, and there are, I'm quite willing to admit, things, practices which management does not very much like reporting pay, for example. If you come into work, you get paid for 4 hours even if they don't make you work. Those kinds of practices on their face appear to be not very comprehensible from a managerial efficiency perspective. On the other hand, I have to say they were designed to correct abuses, and they did that. So I take the point that the caller made.
Well, so let's talk about a little further about the 60s and 70s, the period he mentions, because I certainly remember Jimmy Hoffa growing up, another powerful and ultimately corrupt union leaders who really gave the movement a bad name, it would seem.
Absolutely. They did, and Jimmy Hoffa was that great example. Jimmy Hoffa was a man who came up during the hard times of the 1930s and by sheer force of character created the Teamsters Union, or reinvigorated the Teamsters Union. And at some point, he became embroiled with organized crime. I agree with that. Those things do happen. But to tar the entire labor movement with that kind of corruption is a vast over-exaggeration. And I would say, furthermore, the people who were the members who were working under Jimmy Hoffa enjoyed fairly good working conditions and wages.
We have talked about numbers of jobs, but not so much about the working conditions and wages, pay, benefits, all that realm. Even with union representation, have a number of companies gotten concessions from workers in recent years?
Absolutely. They come into a situation, Caterpillar is one. They come into a situation and they say, we believe that we have more strength to outlast your union strike, and therefore we are asking for concessions. And they get them. The Caterpillar strike of, I think it was 2012, was devastating to the union. They created a two-tier wage program, which is anathema to unions. They went from a defined benefit pension plan to a defined contribution plan, thereby further eroding the security of American workers. All of these things had an impact and effect, and employers, they realize when they have the momentum behind them, they realize they can get concessions, and sometimes they ask for them.
And in the cases where they've gotten them, what's the general financial health and of those companies and their stockholders?
Good. Absolutely good. Why do companies exist? They exist to enrich shareholders. I understand that's the nature of capitalism. I understand that's the way companies tend to view things. Who can blame them? They're subject to the whims and desires of shareholders if they're not doing a good job. The great economist Milton Friedman pointed this out over and over. If shareholders don't like what companies are doing, let them sell the stock. When that starts to happen, they need to do something to recoup profits.
Let's take another call. We have Paul in Talent on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Raymond Hogler about his book, The End of American Labor Unions. Hi, Paul.
Issue of shareholders in the capitalist system, that's the problem with the labor unions. Labor unions are concocted because they're actually wage earners as opposed to joint venture partners. The beginning of capitalism had labor working alongside of management because they were partners, and so they were all dedicated to the same purpose and received profit shares. So when I incorporated and I would hire people, our agreement was that they would have a vested interest in the company, and they have the right to continue to buy shares in the company, and therefore equally share in the profits of the company and the management decisions of the company. And that was a much more equitable and satisfactory division of labor.
All right.
There was no hierarchy. They couldn't be, wouldn't share in the ultimate goal of the business itself.
Okay, thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it. It's a perspective from you, Raymond, about profit sharing and giving employees a feel like they have a stake in the outcome.
Sure. One of the best places to work in the United States is for Lincoln Electric, if you can get a job.
That's the place in Cleveland?
Yes. Lincoln Electric was founded in 1925 by the Lincoln brothers. From their founding on, they had exactly what the caller described, a profit-sharing system. They continue that. There's a great book published about 2 years ago named Spark by a Canadian author, Frank Kohler, who describes in great detail and convincing detail how very effective this company's labor policies are. They don't have a union, but they have an employee ownership program. I have to say that in 1914, in the Ludlow Massacre at the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company, owned by John D. Rockefeller Jr., the outcome of that was one of these sharing sort of arrangements whereby Rockefeller organized his own internal representation committee and help to ensure workers that they would get a fair deal, better working conditions, better wages. And that was a very successful program. It continued on in the United States up until the 1930s when the Depression more or less ended those kind of arrangements.
So the original idea was to include the workers as part of the overall vision of the future of the company, but it when money got tight, it became much more adversarial?
Yes, and it's a little more complicated than that. What happened was that these programs were very widespread among the United States. There were even, at one time, there were more people in employee representation committees than in trade unions, that is, representation in the workplace. when the Depression came along and Robert Wagner was drafting his act, he had a very difficult time dealing with these company unions. He decided, for reasons which are very good, but I can't go into here, to ban them. Section 8A2 says no company unions. In other words, they abolished these things like works councils of Volkswagen and other internal forms of representation. Wagner did that because he believed only trade unions would be able to exercise the necessary economic power to get the company, the country back on economic track by helping to redistribute wealth. That's the purpose of it. But the caller is exactly right. These things were around and they worked.
Did that term redistribute wealth ever get used out loud?
All the time.
Really?
Yeah.
It certainly seems like it's a bad, dirty phrase now, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but when Wagner said it, he didn't say just redistribute wealth for the sake of it. He said in order to make the economy function again in the Depression, we need to be able to provide purchasing power. Maybe you like the term better, consumer demand, but we need to be able to stimulate consumer demand so that people will buy goods and services that are available, thereby stimulating the economy.
Or as Henry Ford once said, I need to pay my workers enough to be able to afford to buy my cars.
Exactly right.
We're talking to Raymond Hogler about the end of American labor unions, his book out last year. I want to talk about changing economic conditions, though, because that always seems to figure largely in the labor movement. And it seems like in some cases, especially in the car building business, there were assumptions about things like pensions made when money was coming in hand over fist. Did somebody ever say, you know, the money might not always be coming in quite like this and we might want to put a little aside for later?
Partly it was demographics, and partly it's because this same problem exists with Social Security. People who are paying into it now are providing pensions for people who are retiring. There's a massive demographic out there which is retiring right now and places a tremendous burden on Social Security. So when they negotiated these defined benefit pension plans, it wasn't so easy to look down the road and say, there will come a time in America when we don't have as many workers or when our economy is not as good. They thought conditions were going to continue just the way they have. And these defined contribution plans, I'm sorry, the defined benefit plans are a problem for employers because they have to pay for them. Part of that is what drives this attack on public sector unions, where there's still many defined benefit pension plans in existence.
So let's talk about, I haven't mentioned from the beginning of this, that you're a lawyer, and there always seem to have been waves of laws over unions. Is there a cycle you can sort of point to, like every 13 years or 25 or something, that laws...
I don't think it comes necessarily in those kinds of cycles. Mm-hmm. I think it depends on economic conditions. And the cycles were, prior to the Great Depression and the crash, very good economic times in which employers were very active at discouraging unions. On the cusp of the Depression, there was about as much labor union membership as there is right now. After the Depression, when people started to flock to unions, it grew very rapidly. Part, in my opinion, part of the problem was these laws have failed to evolve as conditions changed. In 1978, we had a provision put forward to Congress, a Labor Reform Act, which would have made union organizing much easier. And I think it was necessary at that time, or it was a good idea at that time, because labor unions were already experiencing some difficulty because of poor economic conditions. That was defeated by a filibuster, and that filibuster was led by Orrin Hatch of Utah, Senator Orrin Hatch. And they went through, I think, 11 cloture votes every time labor reform lost.
Really? Okay. As we've already laid out earlier in the program, it doesn't look like things will get much better with Republican administration and Congress and potentially Supreme Court as well. The book is called The End of American Labor Unions, The Right to Work Movement and the Erosion of Collective Bargaining. Raymond Hogler is a professor of management at Colorado State and its author. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange, Professor.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.